Your computer is a piece of yourself. It's your music collection, your photo memories, notes to yourself, an archive of who you are, the record of everyone you've ever contacted, what you said. We think of our networks as social, that's what they're called, but are they? We expect our interactions with the computer to imitate something human. There's Siri.
How may I help you?
Who you either love or who just creeps you out. There are the imaginary cognitive operating systems that think they could become your friend, a very close friend in the case of the movie Her.
Theodore, how long before you're ready to date?
What do you mean?
I saw in your emails that you'd gone through a breakup recently.
I've gone on dates.
Well, then you can go on one with this woman. And then you could tell me all about it. You could kiss her.
Samantha.
What?
I can't believe I'm having this conversation with my computer.
But this is not so far-fetched. For thoughtful people, our computer interactions are all human. A user interacting with a coder. Is there a way to be a part of the low-tech software innards of our computers? Nathan Schneider says yes, and it's as simple as knowing the people who create the computer environments we use. This journalist and thinker compares this approach to computing to the difference between fast food and slow food. Norman says, ditch Google and Facebook, create a server network with other people, and the cloud becomes your cloud. It's like knowing where the food you eat comes from.
The slow food movement really started out with a fascination with experience and wanting to recapture that kind of old way of relating to food rather than cans and fast food. What actually came to be through the movement was a recognition that this was about more than aesthetics. It was about community. It was about how we relate to the people around us, how we build economies around us. And that's actually something that I've been discovering in my encounters with slow computing. Some of the tools that have really stuck with me, for instance, are the text editors that have been under development for decades now. What I use to write with most of the time is something called Emacs, which was first developed in the 1970s. It does everything that I need it to do, and I found it to be an actually superior tool than, for instance, Microsoft Word in many respects, because it brings me closer to the text, and it also puts me kind of in conversation with the decades of developers who've been building this.
So your social network is the other programmers who helped make the language, and the superior part comes from the fact that you're closer to the computer, so therefore you can do translations much easier. You can go from one format to another in Emacs much more easily than you can do it in Microsoft Word.
Yeah, one of the things that you notice about tools like this is that they were built out of need. Whenever the next version of Microsoft Word comes out, you know, it's built to serve a very specific commercial purpose. It's built to make a profit for Microsoft. And you can tell that the tools that go into each sequential version of Emacs were built by people who are using it, less a commercial need than a personal need or a community need. And that makes a real difference.
So it's like wiki text. Everybody's trying to work it out together.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the challenge now is to try to translate this process into the internet, into a moment where more and more of our lives are on the cloud. More and more of us are dependent on tools like Gmail and Dropbox and Google Docs.
Now, you've made a stab at this. You really experimented with how you can create an alternative cloud that works just exactly like the regular cloud, but it has some features that you would never expect from a impenetrable, opaque kind of server.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's really striking as you start building a kind of community-based internet, a slow internet for yourself, is you have to do it differently. You have to relate to people differently. You know, I work with an organization of which I'm a member called May First, and a lot of my cloud services are hosted through an open source program called OwnCloud. And often that means that I'm interacting with those people. I'm interacting with the people who are managing the server. I'm interacting with the developers of OwnCloud to see what's coming up next, to see whether new features are possible that I can see a need for.
So how does that work exactly? You'll be doing something, you'll be downloading something, and somebody will pop up in a little text message and say, hey, Nathan, is this your file here, this big, huge file? We wish you'd make it smaller using this program.
Well, normally it's me reaching out to them. Uh-huh. And there's a whole practice for how to do this in open source software development. For instance, one files a bug report. You know, when something goes wrong with an open source tool, rather than sending it to the company and having the company hide it and protect it from being seen by anybody else where it might affect the company's valuation, in open source development, those bug reports are public. Anyone can see them. And therefore, the whole community joins together and tries to solve the problem together. So it's a very different approach to problem solving than what one finds in proprietary software.
Do you ever solve a bug?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah. Often what happens is, you know, I'll submit something. Either I'll get a reply about, okay, if you just tweak this here, that'll fix the problem. Or, you know, somewhere down the line, maybe the next version, maybe two versions down, there will be some kind of solution.
Now, I have plenty of stuff stored in Google's cloud, and I have no idea where it is. But you, on the other hand, know exactly where your cloud stuff is.
Yeah, actually, it turns out that the servers are located in a building not far from here in Lower Manhattan.
And you could go and talk to the people who run them and...
Yeah, absolutely, to the extent that I like. You know, these things require a bit more patience to learn, a bit more patience to solve some of the problems. But one of the things that I realized that kind of surprised me was that the glitches started to feel different when I started relating to software this way, when I started using more and more open source tools. They felt less like a moment of frustration before some big company that I have no control over, but they began to feel like an interesting challenge. Oh, there's something going wrong. You know, how can we solve that? How can we go about putting this right?
So it's not some technological death force that's ruining your life. It's a collective of architects building a building together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a real challenge right now to expand that collective. Right now, open source software development is very white, very male. It's built a culture that has kind of enforced that and created boundaries for people.
What about these two young people who created this social network around the Ferguson unrest and who really mobilized an entire kind of civil rights movement?
I think that's a great example. One challenge, though, is they're relying on a lot of the closed systems like Facebook and Twitter that many of us continue to rely on. My question is, how much more powerful could a movement like this be if we're not dependent on services that are really fundamentally designed to deliver advertising?
So tell our listeners what they could do, like right now, with their computer to bring up the command line and search for something that would give them a taste of exactly what you're talking about here.
The most important thing, I think, is to take it one step at a time. You know, to try one tool at a time, to just play around. And there are a few places one can go to learn more. For instance, alternative2.net is one that I use a lot for just entering in commonly used commercial tools and then getting a list of alternatives. But to me, the most important question is how we're relating to each other, whether we're building business models around the online economy that really support people flourishing. We get a lot of stuff for free, but the price we pay is often surveillance, advertising. I think it's time that we start asking really hard questions about that and experimenting with building business models that do things very differently.
Nathan Schneider is a freelance journalist. His article in The New Republic, The Joy of Slow Computing, talks about all of what we've been talking about and a lot more. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.